Hi, welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, on Twitter at Literary Italy. You can go to our website, literaryitaly.com. If you want to send us a note, please send us an email at mail@literaryitaly.com. Today's show, we're going to talk about Anna Maria Ortese's Neapolitan Chronicles.
Well, specifically one story.
One story, a pair of eyeglasses. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Jim.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm a little tired.
We're all a little tired.
Oh, it's we should not wait until Sunday night to record the podcast.
Ooh, I feel like we
It's like sort of the classic school kid move, though.
We just peeled back the curtain a little bit.
Oh, it's almost 10 o'clock Sunday night.
Why are you doing that?
Okay, all right.
Now I feel terrible. I feel like, why don't you tell how we sleep at night, like what we wear? I feel violated right now.
So Anna Maria Ortese, born 1914 or so in Rome. Her father was a low-level government employee, and so the family moved around quite a bit. In Italy, mostly southern Italy, and also 3 years in Tripoli in Libya. And when she was an adolescent, they came and spent several years in Naples. Her mother was from Naples. So it was a little bit of a home turf for the family. And Naples is pretty important in her writing, but important in a conflicted kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I think certainly this collection reveals that. This is a, although the book was published in 1953 with the title Il Mare Non Bagna Napoli, which literally means the sea does not bathe Naples. It's translated here by the translators Anne Goldstein and Jenny McPhee as Neapolitan Chronicles. Anne Goldstein, you may recognize the name from she's a translator of the Elena Fronte. She's pretty much the exclusive translator, I think, of Elena Fronte. So if you've read the Neapolitan novels by Elena Fronte, I wonder, to be totally honest, if they use Neapolitan Chronicles because it will catch the eye of someone who's familiar with...
Who's reading the Neapolitan novels.
Yes, right. Yes. And in fact, I mean, I was thinking of this episode as being a little bit of a, if you like the works of Elena Fronte, you might also like Anna Maria Ortese. And it should be something that you'll be able to find because it is a recently translated book, not a recently published, written book.
Well, the translation is recently published.
Yes.
It is a new translation.
It's a new translation. So,
and the last translation is from 50 years, half a century earlier. So this is an event.
Yes. Okay. So it's an interesting book because it has five, tales. Three of them are fiction, and two are nonfiction. And so they vary. They all center around Naples. So that's hence the focus of Naples in the title. But they have various ways of expressing that. This particular and also again, this is 1953. This is post World War II Naples, and I think that we for sure talked a little bit about this in My Brilliant Friend, especially that first book in the Neapolitan novel series, My Brilliant Friend, because this is the Naples of post-World War II just beginning to pull itself out of the rubble. Naples was the most heavily bombed city in Italy. Basically, towards the end, so 1943, the Germans were there initially because of being on the same side as the Italians, but as the tide began to turn and Mussolini fell from power, it became really a German occupation.
Yes.
The
Germans occupied Italy
They occupied Naples, and there was extensive bombing by British, but mostly American forces.
Now, when we were there, we took a tour of Naples underground. And, Naples having kind of a whole passage of subterranean caves during the war, during the occupation, that became kind of a refuge for Neapolitans to stay. There were people who lived basically underground and foraged when German soldiers were not around for food. They would go up above, try to gather as much food, and then bring it underground. They're enormous caves. It's a fascinating tour. If you go to Naples, I highly recommend it. It's really it's really stunning.
Yeah, Napoli Sotterranea, mm-hmm. or Naples Underground Tour. And this idea of like an underground Naples, I think, is something that is very vivid in the imagination. I think we tend to think, oh, that's something inherent to Naples. But I kind of wonder, reading this and also reading Elena Ferrante and just reading a little bit of the history, you have to understand, Naples was a rich and powerful city, you know, for centuries.
Right.
And not saying that it was rich and powerful until
1943
but this stereotype of Naples as a place where people are kind of underhanded dealings and black market and exploitation, sexual exploitation, exploitation of children and of workers, some of that it has to do with just surviving in a war zone. Mm-hmm. And so that tends to be, you know, this is the Naples that she's really focusing on in this 1953 book, Il Mare Non Bagna Napoli. We were just talking before we began recording, just this title, as I said, it literally means the sea doesn't bathe Naples. And the author is no longer with us. You know, she died in 1998, so I can't ask her, what exactly did you mean by this? You know, it could mean... Yeah, I take it as the sense that the sea doesn't wash Naples. Like the sea doesn't. I think there's another translation, English translation, that gives the sense of the bay is not Naples. Like Naples is more than just that pretty view of Vesuvius in the background and the beautiful blue sea and the sparkling water and the sunshine, the lemons or whatever. There's more to it. There's more to it than the sea. I also, maybe it gives the sense of the sea doesn't clean it. Like it doesn't wash away the grime and the dirt. And literal, I mean, she talks a lot about grime and dirt in this, literal grime and dirt, but also the you know, just kind of the anger and the bad will. There's a lot of really hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
Hurting people in this story. Well, maybe we should give a summary of the...
Oh, praises. Yes.
Yeah. Do you...
See, Eugenia is a young girl in a family of, I believe, of five. Her older sisters are nuns, and she's got two younger brother and a younger sister. A very poor family, and... First of all, the story that we're reading, I mentioned Neapolitan Chronicles, as Anne said, the sea bathes or washes Naples. This story that we read is a pair of sunglasses.
Eyeglasses.
I said sunglasses. Yeah. Yes, thank you very much. That actually comes up a little bit in the story, right? Because one of the, anyway, we may come to that. It centers around Eugenia, her need for glasses, and her aunt who has a spinster aunt who is going to generously, I use that word guardedly, generously pay for her much needed glasses. And she gives out many times, her optometrist's diagnosis that Eugenie is practically blind. So these glasses represent a kind of new vision for her, at which when she tries them twice. She tries them at the beginning of the story when she's recalling having been at the optometrist, and she sees in the Via Roma, kind of in the center of the commercial center of the city, she sees a city of beauty. And then the meat of the story is her expectation, waiting for these glasses to come when her mother will bring them to her.
Right. Can I read this a little bit from that scene?
Sure.
And right away, this is, so she tries on the glasses in the optometrist, at the optometrist. And right away, while Eugenia, sitting on a stool, waiting anxiously. He had placed over her eyes another pair of lenses with a white metal frame and had said, "Now look into the street." Eugenia stood up, her legs trembling with emotion, and was unable to suppress a little cry of joy. On the sidewalk, so many well-dressed people were passing, slightly smaller than normal, but very distinct. Ladies in silk dresses with powdered faces, young men with long hair and bright-colored sweaters, white-bearded old men with pink hands resting on silver-handled canes. And in the middle of the street, some beautiful automobiles that looked like toys, their bodies painted red or teal, all shiny. Green trolleys as big as houses with their windows lowered. And behind the windows, so many people in elegant clothes. And it goes on.
Yeah. And that's, you know, there were, as I recall, sort of walking down the main thoroughfares near, I think Chiaia is one of the neighborhoods. And they're very, you know, there are some very Tony shops.
And it's an elegant area,
and a sense of, and a high sense of style. At the end, her her mother brings home the glasses that her aunt has paid, and she tries them on. And now she's going to look at the locale where her parents live. And her parents are, gosh, I mean, the only way I can describe them is as almost modern day contadini. You know, I mean, there's a sense in which there's the marchesa. Literally, there's a noble woman, I don't know how literal that is, but who is kind of very patronizing and saying, "Oh, well, maybe you don't want to spend 8,000 lira on glasses." I keep saying sunglasses. I don't know why. You maybe don't need to spend 8,000 lira. I saw a pair in the shop that were 2,000 lira, which to me is kind of the whole point. Usually is that they're prescribed for you, right? They're custom made, that you can't simply go and buy a pair of glasses. Anyway, she finally takes these glasses. When her mother brings them, she sees her patch of earth in Naples, and her reaction is to immediately vomit. The family comes around and says, "Oh, these glasses are defective." And someone says, "No, that's what happens when you first see them." And the story ends with the aunt finally saying, 8,000 lira. I can't believe, you know, we spent 8,000 lira on this." That figure keeps coming up again over and over. And that 8,000 lira, you know, but I think if we think about just the typical cost, if you think about the cost of a pair of glasses today, I don't think it's that far removed. But for a poor family, buying a pair of glasses is an expense. I mean, it's an expense now. If you spend $100 or $200 on a pair of glasses, that's significant, particularly if you're on the margins.
Right. And I think you also have to go back to that something her very bitter Aunt Nunziata says to her, because she, you know, as you said, generously, this is a sacrifice for the aunt as well.
It is, absolutely.
A huge sacrifice. And she says to her, I wish I could find the page. I just lost the page.
Well, she actually foreshadows. She says,
it's better not to see. And when Eugenia does see, you know, as Jim was talking about that scene where she finally, these long-awaited glasses, Eugenia, still holding on to the eyeglasses with her hands, went to the entrance to the courtyard to look outside into the Vicolo della Cupa. So this scene mirrors that earlier scene when she's in the optometrist. However, when she was at the optometrist, she was in the, you know, the well-heeled part of town. Now she's in her crummy neighborhood.
Yeah.
Her legs were trembling, her head was spinning, and she no longer felt any joy. With her white lips, she wished to smile, but the smile became a moronic grimace. Suddenly, the balconies began to multiply, 2,000, 100,000. The carts piled with vegetables were falling on her, the voices filling the air. The cries, the lashes struck her head as if she were ill. She turned, swaying toward the courtyard, and that terrible impression intensified. The courtyard was like a sticky funnel, with the narrow end toward the sky, its leprous walls crowded with derelict balconies, the arches of the basement dwellings black with the lights bright in a circle around Our Lady of Sorrows, the pavement white with soapy water, the cabbage leaves, the scraps of paper, the garbage, and in the middle of the courtyard, that group of ragged, deformed souls, faces pocked by poverty and resignation, who looked at her lovingly. And they're all there like grotesque, these grotesque faces, who are like, so how is it? You know, and she can finally see, she finally sees them clearly and she throws up. Yeah.
It's a strange story.
It is a strange story. And it really, I mean, the title is A Pair of Eyeglasses. That's all it's about, is this pair of eyeglasses. And that is the end of it, you know, and Nuncia wringing her hands, a grand total of a good 8,000 lira.
Oh, the reason I guess sunglasses stuck in my head is I think it's Luigino, the boy who's teasing her, says, "Oh, you're going to get glasses. Are they gold?" She says, "Yes, they're gold. I'm getting gold glasses." And she said, and he says, "You know, fashionable women don't get glasses." And she says, "I sell people in the Via Roma." And he says, "Oh, no, fashionable women get sunglasses, not glasses." I think for some reason that stuck sunglasses in my head.
Well, I think it's interesting you bring up that character, because I think he, like just about every character, has this edge to them. You know, this Aunt Nuncia, also her mother, even her father, there's this, and although at the end you see, you know, or she does see them clearly, that they're loving, these loving faces, they're also grotesque and desperate. There's a kind of grasping quality to them. And that makes sense, because they're in they're all in this extremely precarious situation. You know, and the way when she looks up to the balconies and I love that sticky funnel with the narrow end up to the sky, because earlier when she was in the Marquesa's apartment, she went out on her balcony, which opened up grandly, you know, wide to the sky, wide open sky. And this sense of they're like closed in a kind of beehive, but like a dirty beehive. I don't know how to say that, you know, a dark, you know, or maybe a warren.
Well, it's kind of packed. It's you know, to give a completely inappropriate analogy, but it's the way you, in a dystopian, you know, sort of a Blade Runner thing where you see people packed on top of people. That's the way it's described. Your description just then kind of gave it as this. Oh, it's strange because it's so impressionistic. It's not that, it's not necessarily that all of the details are, you know, a lot of it seems to be attitudinal, and it makes me wonder, you know, what is the change in Eugenia that happens at this point? Or is that a narrative device that kind of flashes her forward through her life as she becomes disillusioned?
Right. And this is the end. And is that the end? You know, the thing about people being so crowded in, again, this comes back to World War II, and there's a, first of all, like 25,000, I don't know exactly what the number of Neapolitans were killed. And you have mass homelessness. Mm-hmm. You know, if buildings are destroyed, there's no place. And so people were living in structures that were never meant to hold people. There's this one that she talks in another story about, this place called the Granili, the granaries. This was a huge royal granary that was built for the Bourbon King, that with this immense structure that was meant to hold grain. And eventually, you know, it had various, you know, one time it was used as a hospital, it was used as a storehouse for other things, and basically became like a storehouse for people. And it was just people crowded in, you know, unhygienic living conditions. And she talks about it in another story and really describes it as kind of a Inferno-esque situation, you know, just bodies on top of bodies and people dying. Yeah. So cheery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. She's an interesting author. So with this book, with the nonfiction works, she didn't hold any punches, and she criticized people that she knew, her friends actually, who had been young idealists, you know, kind of the members of the intelligentsia of Naples, and really criticizes them for going, according to her, becoming members of the bourgeoisie. And so that they, rather than trying to improve the situation of the poor classes of Naples. They are just like everyone else.
They're she accused them of being sellouts.
Yeah, that they're just looking to get ahead. They see a chance to get ahead, and they're going to take it. Mm-hmm. And one of the accusations about this book is that it was charged that this book is anti-Naples. That this is a book that's against Naples. That it was critical of Naples, not just critical of the situation, but critical of the city itself. And she did eventually leave the city, and she didn't go back.
Yeah.
I mean, she wasn't welcome there.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting, I think, for the podcast anyway, we try to give authors that are specific to locales, and she's got a range just in terms of her life. And she's born a Roman. She lives for a time in Naples, and towards the end of her life, she spends the last few decades of her life in Liguria. And I think that's, I wonder if you could kind of have a tour that basically, it sounds like it would focus on the Tyrrhenian coast of Italy, that you would sort of run up and down the west coast of Italy. But
Naples is really her fertile ground for her writing.
But she has a career. So she begins writing. She's spurred to write. At least she claims she's spurred to write by the death of her brother.
Right.
And at that point, she's not writing she's not based in Naples when she first starts. And then she has a career in journalism and returns to write. It's a varied career. To the extent that it seems to me that she's also being sort of rediscovered at this point.
This is 1953, you mean?
I mean, now she's republished. I think at her death, I don't know how current she was. Her fame seems to have rallies and seems to ebb and flow.
Before her death, she was republished in Italian, and that sort of kind of had a renewed interest. I think about.
But she first writes before the war, right? I mean, she's first writing in the 30s.
Right, but then she goes, as you said, she goes more towards journalism.
Yeah.
Returns to Naples and starts writing fiction again. Mm-hmm. There is something about Naples that brings out the poetry in her, I think. And I do think she's a very poetic kind of writer.
She was in Milan for a time, right? I mean, that's part of her story.
Yes, so. Also lived in Florence, lived in Rome. But I do think that she's rightly associated with Naples, because mm-hmm. I think that Naples, for her, has this important quality that brings out, I think, her most, I don't mean color, I was going to say color, but most vivid writing. So, let's see. This collection won the Viareggio Prize, which is one of the most important literary prizes in Italy. A later book called The Iguana, 1965, a novel, won. That didn't win the Strega Prize. There was another one, The Poor and
Poveri
Simple.
Poveri e Semplici.
Poveri e Semplici. Won the Strega Prize. So she was well recognized during her lifetime. I mean, it's not.
No, right. But I guess the point being, I mean, she's been newly translated 3 years ago into English. I just wonder that she's. And there was in 2001, the story we read was made into a short film. Mm.
The eyeglasses.
The eyeglasses, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So.
In fact, if there is a short film you can probably find on YouTube. We found on YouTube.
Yeah, maybe
that is
we can
an
link
adaptation.
It.
We can link it in the show notes.
So as far as places, I mean, Naples is the obvious one. And we, Jim already mentioned Napoli Sotterranea. They have cropped up these tours of Naples, these My Brilliant Friend tours, and it would sort of be similar neighborhoods to what Ortese is describing. And this is not the Naples of, where you go to Capri or, sunning yourself on the beach. This is the gritty Naples. And more of a historic, more of a modern, modern history of Naples, or I should say 20th century history of Naples. In addition, there's a ton of stuff to see in Naples, and I would have to go back to the podcast from Elena Ferrante to remember all things. But we talked about some of the various museums, and you know, you can go to the section, the Chiaia section is still, you know, it is still the shopping district, and it's where people would promenade, you know, the wealthier Benestanti, you know, the people that they're well-to-do people would go and to see and be seen. As Jim mentioned, towards the end of her life, I guess about the last 20 years of her life, she moved in with her sister, with one of her sisters, who I think was a postal employee. At any rate, she had a steady job because as a writer, Ortese, that was something she always struggled with, was finances, because she really, it wasn't steady. And that's where she stayed, in this town of Rapallo on the Ligurian coast between Genoa and the Cinque Terre. And Rapallo, we may have mentioned, I think, in the episode on Montale when we were talking about the Cinque Terre, because it can sometimes people are looking for a place to stay near the Cinque Terre that is not that are not as expensive or crowded as the Cinque Terre. That could make a good
home base. I was about to say the crowded in the sense of crowded by other tourists, right? Because Rapallo will be crowded in the sense that it's a city. It's a
it's a small city.
I would call
it's a town.
A city of to me it. And now you're talking to a small town boy. So when I hear a 30,000 population, I go, that's a small city.
It's okay. So it's a, but it's certainly bigger than many of these smaller, the Cinque Terre, Camogli.
Those are like a few thousand, a few hundred. Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you do have a seaside, you do have beaches. It's accessible by train, which is a plus because you can get there from Genoa, you can get there. You can take the train in the other direction heading toward the Cinque Terre, which also means that you can visit those places by train using Rapallo as a home base. It's also a more, it's a more walkable city. It's not as hilly. You know, the Cinque Terre are built right on that hillside. So if you have difficulty, if you have mobility issues in the Cinque Terre, you're really going to have to rely on some kind of transportation. There are some taxis, and obviously there there are the trains between the villages. But really, I think the beauty of the Cinque Terre is the hiking. I mean, I always like hiking, but if you find it hard to get around, a place like Rapallo might be a better home base.
Yeah, poking around, we've seen a number of people who've used it as a base for, because not just for the Cinque Terre, but then you can also use that to get to Genova, as opposed to staying in Genova. That's a bit of a haul to get out to the Cinque. So it's kind of a midpoint for both of those, and it's on the sea, and there's a number of really beautiful views that you get of the Mediterranean.
And beaches and hiking and all
and
that.
Hiking, yeah.
Ezra Pound used it as a home base.
Ezra Pound and who's the other?
Yeats.
Another Yeats.
Yeats, yeah.
So it's got a literary background with the
and
foreign
Anna
poets.
Maria Ortega.
Yeah.
So those are two of the places: Naples, Rapallo. I mean, two coastal towns. Obviously, Naples a big city. Rapallo, a very small city.
I'm sorry. Okay, we'll call it a town. It doesn't matter.
Big town, right.
It's a big... I'm also thinking, in terms of the towns that are just coming off the Via Francigena, I would be... They'd be like, oh my gosh, it's crowded here.
Right, because there's like 1,000 people, maybe. It's... And I'm not sure, when they say 30,000 inhabitants, what that territory...
It's covers. Pretty clustered, though. I mean, if you look at it, it's dense. Yeah. But you know, 30,000 is. I think of something like Viterbo is probably about a town of about 30,000.
So Anna Maria Ortese, this fairly newly translated volume is called Neapolitan Chronicles, published in 2018, and this particular story that we read was the a pair of eyeglasses, right?
Paio di Occhiali.
The other two short stories, the works of fiction in here, are Family Interior, which again deals with family in desperate straits and squalor, and The Gold of Forcella, which is about kind of these old ladies selling, you know, family heirlooms just for some cash. And so they are kind of depressing stories when I,
as I'm reading. But this. I think the thing, so one of the, I won't go as far as the, one of the critics who in the Wall Street Journal, writing the Wall Street Journal a few years ago, denigrated it in comparison with things, some of the stuff we've read, in particular, Christ Stopped at Eboli. I think because Christ Stopped at Eboli is a bit more uplifting, but I think reading both together would be a good thing. I think if you were to read both Christ Stopped at Eboli, I think the criticism and that you were making of that, one could look at that and say that's a bit of a Pollyanna-ish. It might be a little and possibly a little bit condescending. And I think that, or you might look at something like this and say, this is cynical and, critical and harsh, that it's condescending in a different, that the other thing is kind of condescending in terms of low expectations. And this is, look at these peons, that this is insulting. I don't know that either of those things are true. I think as certainly of the story that I read, but I'd recommend both, and I'd say come to your own conclusions. But and I think they give you different views of the South.
It's more than the South, though. This is post World War II Naples, and I think that's what you can't separate from this book is that this is. And if you have read My Brilliant Friend or seen the HBO series, that's what you're seeing is for those girls. I think we talked about in the episode is that for those girls, they don't have a memory of pre World War II Naples. In fact, they hardly, or I think they're born just after World War II, so they hardly have a memory of World War II, if they have any at all. So they are that first generation born after mm-hmm. the devastation.
Yep.
So it really is it's an interesting time, and I think it is. I think this is a good time considering what we're going 70 years ago. It's a good time to reflect back on sure. on that period.
Great.
Okay, oh, we are just, by the way, if you want to start hunting down a couple of books, because we're going to start, there are a couple of novels.
You're always pulling these things.
I know. Well, it's not going to be next week, but we will be reading Manzoni's The Betrothed, I Promessi Sposi.
Okay.
And talking about Milan and the Lakes region in Lombardy. And at a future date to be announced, we will also be reading Italo Svevo's La coscienza di Zeno, Zeno's conscience, Svevo, Svevo, and The City of Trieste. And if you have any ideas for a show,
we might go back to Mr. Alighieri.
Yes, and we will be returning to Dante with another episode on Dante and Florence.
Yep.
All right.
And then the swimsuit competition.
That will be Dante and Boccaccio,
yes.
And I'm all, you know, Boccaccio and his Speedo will be really, that
it's
would
good.
Be a sight.
It's good. All right. Alla prossima.